Were you at the Pan International Congress, I believe, around 1988 or 87?
What Congress?
The Pan International Congress here.
Pan International, maybe, and on some panel or something?
I believe, as I recall, I think you were, it might have been Rembar, but I'm pretty sure it was you.
Maybe Rembar.
Was that, I believe, what was it, that hotel overlooking Central Park? Not the plaza, but the...
Yeah, I don't think... I don't think...
Yeah, that was an extremely interesting panel on censorship and the changes that were made. Maybe you weren't at that one. I can't remember now. It's been so many years. That was only one of... The whole thing lasted a week, and that was only one of many panels, but one of the most interesting.
Yeah.
Because censorship has always been a major factor in our lives and something that many people in the arts, and including journalists, have tried to escape. But in your book, you actually start, I believe, with Ulysses, don't you?
I open the book with Ulysses. Well, actually, with Ida Craddock, who committed suicide after, rather than go back to prison for publishing alleged obscenity. She had written a booklet, Advice to the Bridegroom, and Anthony Comstock, he was in his heyday, and he saw that she was prosecuted both in the federal court and the state court. For being too particular in her advice to a bridegroom, and after she was had spent a little time in state prison and came out and was prosecuted under the federal laws, obscenity laws, and was convicted again, she slit her wrist and gassed herself instead of showing up in court to go to prison, and she left a note saying that she did it because the courts had condemned her at the instance of Anthony Comstock of writing and publishing obscenity.
Approximately what year was that?
That was about 1900.
Perhaps you ought to explain who Anthony Comstock was.
Well, Anthony Comstock... today we have a figure, Donald Wildman, who reminds me of Anthony Comstock. You know, Donald Wildman is... an evangelical minister who has is the founder of the American Family Association, and he and his group create tremendous pressures on law enforcement officials and also on advertisers and broadcasters, media. Managers of all kinds to keep off of the air or out of print material that he doesn't like, that offends his sense of decency, or that he feels is blasphemous.
But he has no governmental power. Comstock actually had governmental authority, didn't he?
Yes, for a while, Comstock, he had authority under the post office. I think it was an unpaid job. He was an agent for the post office, and he had the authority, or at least he exerted the authority, of opening mail and seizing anything from the mail that he thought was obscene. In his early days, about the time, a little earlier, a little before Ida Craddock, he had brought about prosecutions of the publisher of Tolstoy's work, of the publisher of Gabriel D'Annunzio's work, and some of those prosecutions, which were of eminent authors, were not successful. I remember the New York Times complaining in about 1889, I think it was, of how Comstock's activities were causing the sales of D'Annunzio's novels and Tolstoy's novels to boom in New York. But he also had powers. He was the founder of the New York Society for the Suppression of Vice. And that society, in the beginning, had powers of arrest and seizure. Those powers, seizure of books, those powers were exercised well into the 40s.
That's extraordinary, though, a society. I mean, that's not really, it became a governmental arm, but it's not really part of government.
It's not part of government, and it wasn't part of government, but in fact, they were entitled to, by New York law, they had been chartered under New York law, and they not only had this authority to institute prosecutions and arrest and seize books by law, they also had by law the right to half the fines that were levied against anyone who was convicted under the obscenity laws that they were, in effect, enforcing. You can do about anything by law, and they, at that time, as I say, by law, they had these powers. But the society, Comstock was succeeded by a man named John Sumner, who was much less flamboyant and less of a religious fanatic, but who was very effective. And as late as 1946, John Sumner succeeded in totally suppressing a great novel by Edmund Wilson called Memoirs of Heckity County, which had been published by Doubleday, one of the largest, perhaps the largest publisher in the world. And Doubleday, Doubleday still has stores, and at that time it had a chain of bookstores where it sold not only its own books, but the books of all the publishers. And John Sumner took a corps of police and arrested, and they raided the Doubleday bookstores without any court action. They had a warrant, which was issued as a matter of course by magistrates in New York at the time to Sumner, as an agent of the Society for the Suppression of Vice, and they went around to all the Doubleday stores and seized all the copies of Memoirs of Heckity County that they could find. They also went to the warehouse and took everything out of the warehouse. That was, as they say, as late as 1946. This is the only book that Edmund Wilson, who's one of our greatest literary critics and thinkers, really. It was the only book that he ever made any money on. He always lived hand to mouth, and when this book was published, which was a book about the sexual mores of the people in an exurb of New York, he started to make some money. And John Sumner, the Society for Vice, or for the Protection Against Vice, succeeded in, I think it had made the bestseller list. It sold for about 6 months, and from that he made more money, either that first 6 months, because it got on the bestseller list, he made more money, I think, than from any other, or all of his other publications put together, and all of his other books. But the raid and the criminal prosecution that resulted against Doubleday completely stopped the publication of the book. The case went all the way up to the Supreme Court, and when the Supreme Court divided 4-4, the result was an automatic affirmance of Doubleday's conviction, which meant that the book was then suppressed all over the country. And it wasn't until, that was in 1948, it wasn't until 1959, I think, that Roger Strauss, of Farrar Straus, I think it was called Farrar Straus and Girard at the time, Roger brought it out in a new edition. But even at that late date, Roger went and talked to the, or had someone talk to the New York prosecutor, who was a guy named Frank Hogan, a Catholic, who was very zealous about obscene books, and to see if it was all right to go ahead and publish it. So as late as the late 40s and early 50s in this country, we still had a formidable institutions threatening the freedom of publishers and authors.
Now, your book, it would be a prime target for the Watch and Ward Society and other outfits like that, because you have excerpts from Wilson's work and from Ginsberg and from Burroughs and so forth, and some very explicit passages you have there. Yeah. If your book had been published in the 1950s, 1940s, God help us.
I wouldn't be sitting here.
It would never see the light of day, would it?
Yeah. No, I don't think it would have. In writing this book, since I wanted to show what the struggle was actually all about, and particularly what it meant for the authors and publishers involved, and I also wanted to show how the printed word, at least, has been liberated over the past 80, 90 years. It seemed to me desirable to quote at length from the authors and from the books that they wrote.
You didn't do it just to titillate.
I wouldn't do it to titillate, no. I was trying to think whether I would do it to arouse lust, but I don't think I'd do it for that reason either.
I don't think any of those passages arouses lust.
No, and I think they're shocking. Some of them are very shocking. The other day I was talking to a group in New Canaan, Connecticut at the library there about the book and about censorship, and I thought it appropriate to read to them from some of the books, and I read to them one of the passages that I have here in the book from William Burroughs' Naked Lunch, and I cautioned them before I read it, but they wanted to hear it, and even though this was one of the last books to be attacked as literature, last pieces of literature to be attacked in this country in the 60s, and that was a long time ago, it is still extremely shocking language. And but no one fainted, and no one called the police. And
of course, you were reading it out of context. If you read it in the context of the book itself, it seems to be less shocking, because the whole book is
in the context of my book or Burroughs'
book. No, in the context of Burroughs' of Naked Lunch.
Yes, sure. It's
so
less shocking.
You have examples of prosecutors who. Go through a book and they
and ripped it
page
out,
65
ripped it.
And they read that, and then they go to page 86 and they read that,
right.
And so there was no way for a jury or a judge to judge the book
as
in
whole,
the context of the work itself. All they saw were excerpts, which then in themselves could be shocking, but perhaps not so if you read the entire work.
Right. Yes, I think that's right, and I think that it was certainly much more shocking to hear me read these words out of the context, both of my book and of Burroughs' book.
Now, what is it, or was it, in our psyche, I guess I should say is, because it's still around to a degree, that people, one, would want to censor other people, and two, that people would allow themselves to be censored, because Americans accepted it. We had censorship boards. When I was a kid, of course, you went to the movies, and there it was approved by the State of Ohio Censorship Board. And that movie was all right for me to see. I was going to be spared any trauma in my adolescence as a result. So Americans submitted to it. See, it's a double-edged sword here. The people who want to censor and those who accept it. What? Why? Why?
Well, I think for a long time, many Americans, like many people elsewhere too, but with our Protestant and Puritan background, I think more than many other, for example, European peoples, we get excited about sex, and we have a lot of ambivalence about sex and the expression of sex, and fears of the printed word also, fears of even talking about sex. This goes back a long way. It goes back really to the late 19th century, when you couldn't talk about anything having to do with sex at the dinner table or anywhere, even in the family. But the problem with censorship is that it involves, as you suggested, some people telling other people what they can and cannot read or listen to or see. If it's in a movie, there are people telling you what you can see. If it's in books, there are people telling you what you can and cannot read. Why they need to do that, why they're impelled to do it, I suppose, is because for them, these words, these ideas, these images, these sexual images and ideas are threatening. They're frightening. They make them angry because of their own personal, psychological, emotional, cultural makeup. But especially in this country, not only with its tradition, not only of freedom, but of diversity, incredible diversity. We're a polyglot nation, made up of people and cultures, perhaps more than any other nation in the world. Very diverse. There has to be, you almost say, I'm almost tempted to say that we, if we didn't have a First Amendment, it would have to be, if the founding fathers hadn't given it to us, we would have to have, someone would have invented it. The courts or someone would have invented it, because I don't see how the people in this country could have, survived as a people without being required, as it were, to tolerate what other people want to see and read and think, regardless of how much it may, how utterly it may conflict with their own values and beliefs. And today, it's not only the sexual, as you know, but it's the religious, and there's certainly a heightened fundamentalist movement in this country, and that's why. In addition to the sexuality, the question of sexuality, the question of religion has come to the forefront in the attempts to censor artists, such as Andres Serrano, whose a really beautiful work, Piss Christ, created a furor in Congress over the funding of the National Endowment on the Arts. And it's one of the things that, and more artists, are communicating, ideas and images about religion or religious figures, about Christ or, that antagonize, people who, whose views about such figures and beliefs are, really very, profoundly disturbed by anything that they see as a criticism or attack.
Well, you know, I don't know why this didn't register, but all of these, as you point out very succinctly, almost all of these efforts at censorship deal with pornography and obscenity. I don't think you have a single excerpt of any effort to censor, say, bloodshed and war or domestic violence or murders or anything. It's all sex and language that relate to sex. So it does deal with our puritanical background, doesn't it?
Yeah, America, this country is a very violent. It's the sexual. I mean, there's a lot of sexual images in the culture, and but there are probably even more violent images, not only in the culture, but in the not only in imagination, in the fantasies, and in the media, but in the streets. We're a terrifically violent country, and although attempts have been made from time to time to try to create a censorship of violence, as well as a censorship of sex, it's it's gotten nowhere. And I think that's in part because, whether it's part of our Puritan background or some other, maybe it's part of the frontier background in the culture, violence is really respected in this country in a way that sex isn't. And, but I think the country, large elements in the country feel that violence is how we got where we are. We're one of the greatest countries in the world, and maybe God's gift to the world. And we got there by violence, and we have to have violence, and we have to have guns. And any attempt to suppress images of the aggression that lies behind violence is given short shrift. Legislatures won't pass laws that suppress violence, and if they did, I doubt that the courts would ever sustain them because of First Amendment considerations.
Well, there is a move of mostly among conservatives to suppress violence by imposing capital punishment, but that is only an extension of violence, isn't it?
You know, capital punishment. Well, that's right. I mean, the this Supreme Court. I mentioned earlier that in passing that Justice William J. Brennan Jr., who recently retired from the court, is the hero of my book, and really the hero of the liberation of literature and art to the extent that it has been liberated in this country. His work on the Supreme Court did that.
Perhaps you ought to explain a little bit about that, in not too many words. It was the Roth case.
Yeah, Brennan began the liberation of literature and art in the Roth case, which was in 1957. It was the first case in which the Supreme Court squarely confronted and talked about in their opinions, in its opinion, the relationship between sex, sexual expression, and the First Amendment, freedom of speech and press, and of the connections between those things and literature and art. And essentially what Brennan said was that, well, first he pointed out that the framers, of the First Amendment, the freedom of speech and press guarantees, considered that the press included the arts. And this had never been spread of record or publicized in a Supreme Court decision before. Up until the 50s, up until this decision, the First Amendment was considered by the courts and by the people generally, by you and me probably as well, to consist only in protection of political ideas. First Amendment guaranteed that persons could express their political ideas freely. But very few people, some of them had become martyrs, some of the few who did see and argue that the First Amendment also had to protect artistic images and literary ideas and the expression of writers and artists, this was really a radically new idea. And Brennan announced it very quietly in Roth versus United States, and it said that literature and art were protected by the Constitution, although obscenity was not. And from that modest and quiet beginning, Brennan sowed a almost invisible revolution, which resulted in the virtually in the liberation of the printed word.
It should be noted that Roth was a pornographer who lost that case and went to jail.
Yeah, Roth went to prison, that's right, as a result of that case, and it's terribly ironic and really tragic that he went to prison for publishing the only prose work that Aubrey Beardsley ever created, called Venus and Tannhäuser. It's also been published as Under the Hill in this country by Grove Press some time ago. Beautiful little erotic thing. A classic. And he went to prison for that. And one of the reasons he went to prison for publishing that, sending that through the mails, was because the Supreme Court, including Brennan, didn't know, or most of the members of the court at the time did not know that's what he had sent through the mails. And they were, in a way, kept from seeing what he had sent through the mails, or appreciating what he had sent through the mails, and the possibility it had literary value and artistic value, by a kind of connivance between the Justice Department, the Solicitor General's Office of the Justice Department at that time, and Justice Felix Frankfurter, both Frankfurter and the Justice Department were very much afraid that the court might find unconstitutional the federal law making it a crime to send obscenity through the mail. This was the so-called Comstock Act.
Yeah, so it was really an issue over the post office's right to censor, not actually what Roth sent.
Well, that's right. The only issue finally taken up by the Supreme Court in Roth's case on his appeal was whether the statute, the power of the post office, of postal censorship of the mails, was constitutional. Now, not whether what he had published was obscene, and they never saw what he published. What they did see, though, during the oral argument, and I talk about this in the book, was a box of hardcore pornography that the Justice Department deposited with the court, and the marshal of the court brought up to the bench while the case was being argued, while Ross' case was being argued, while Ross' fate was being sealed. The justices were not allowed to, given the chance to see what Roth had sent through the mails. Instead, they were shown hardcore pornography of the so-called vilest type, which at that time was terribly shocking to everybody, and they were told, this is what goes through the mail, this is what will continue, what will flood the mails in the American homes if you, the court, decide to reverse Sam Roth's conviction, because you can only do that by declaring the law unconstitutional, the postal obscenity statute, the Comstock law, and that would have left the country defenseless to stop the flood of hardcore pornography. So Roth went down, as a kind of sacrifice to freedom of the arts.
We're going to be running out of time soon. I have a lot of other questions I want to ask you. You have an amusing anecdote about Brennan and this rabid right-winger, Cardinal Spellman, had gone to Truman, I believe, as you stated in the book, saying that he wanted a Catholic on the Supreme Court, and Truman was happy to... it was Truman, right?
Eisenhower.
Yeah, right. And Eisenhower was happy to oblige and appointed Brennan. And as you point out, he was the wrong Catholic.
That's right. And Spellman was very annoyed at the Catholic that he had in the White House, one of the White House staff, for failing to get Eisenhower to check with him on the particular Catholic that he appointed to the court. But Brennan is a marvelous, fantastic man who decided all of his cases independently of the dogma and the teaching of the church to which he still belongs.
I'm not sure that's going to be the case with the current court. We have to keep our fingers crossed.
Yeah, I think that's
right. It remains to be seen.
Yeah.
Now, you were involved as a trial attorney, deeply involved in the effort to overcome censorship, and you were one of the lawyers with Barney Rossett in Grove Press. Tell me about Barney. Now, he is also a hero in your estimation, and one of my heroes as well. Tell me about this and your involvement and what happened.
Well, that's a long story. Barney is not the only client I've ever had as a lawyer, but he's certainly my favorite client. And there was a period of years when he was virtually the only client I had, which meant that I wasn't paid a heck of a lot for a while. That changed when I represented Barney in the defense of I Am Curious Yellow. You know, Barney's not only was a publisher, he also dabbled in films. He had been a filmmaker at one time before he was a publisher, and he imported in 1966, I think it was, the Swedish film I Am Curious Yellow. and as a result of that film, Barney made something like $7 million. On the result of showing that film. And I was the lawyer. I freed the film from customs censorship. Customs had seized it and wanted to stop it from coming into the country. And I handled the trial, and then we lost the trial. It's an interesting story of how that happened. But on appeal to one of the most prestigious courts in the country, the Second Circuit Court of Appeals in New York, the court freed the film. All right, but Barney... And then there were battles all over the country. The film was went wild. I mean, it was a great box office success, and there was litigation all over the country about the film. And nevertheless, we handled it. Barney and I handled the defense and the cases in such a way that the defense did not overwhelm Grove Press, the publisher and distributor, and he was able to make a good deal of money on it. But Barney began, he's a hero. He's the only publisher, I think, brave enough to publish Lady Chatterley's Lover, unexpurgated, in 1959. The only publisher in the country brave enough to publish Henry Miller's Tropic of Cancer, which he did in 1960, I think. Only publisher in the country brave enough to publish William Burroughs' Naked Lunch. a year or so later. In fact, when he published Naked Lunch, he was still fighting desperately in the courts over Tropic of Cancer. And he retained me to, he asked me if I would defend Naked Lunch. He had an understanding with Maurice Gerodias, who was then publishing in Paris, and with Burroughs to try to publish Naked Lunch. He had printed it up. It was in the warehouse. He had 10,000 copies in the warehouse. He was afraid to bring it out, not because he was afraid of going to jail, and not because he was afraid of losing the case, but because he was afraid of the enormous, impossible financial burden that would have resulted if Naked Lunch got embroiled in the courts in the same way that Tropic of Cancer did. Because Tropic of Cancer, even at that time, there were probably, before the Supreme Court finally freed the book in a case that I took to the Supreme Court, Tropic of Cancer was involved in litigation in 60 or 70 different cities in the United States. And Barney was footing the bill on a lot of those cases for the legal bills for the booksellers. And you can't do that. No one can do that.
Didn't you have a rather unusual arrangement with Barney in that you got not only a retainer but a percentage of the royalties?
Right.
That's unusual, isn't it?
Yeah. Barney asked me to read Naked Lunch and a few other books which he wanted to publish and was afraid because of this problem with the legal defense. And I read Naked Lunch, and I thought it was a wonderful book, a shocking book, but a great and important book. And I said, yes, I'll defend it, and I felt I could defend it, and I was right, because the law was evolving then. Brennan was there. I didn't know it was Brennan who was doing it on the court, but Brennan was seeing to it that literature and art got liberated through the decisions and the doctrines that he was building. And so Barney asked me if I would represent the book. I said, yes, and then he said, you know, this is very expensive and so on, and I said, well, money's not too important. It's not the reason I'm here talking to you. I really love to defend this stuff. And if I can do it in some way, work on an arrangement with you, let's do it. So he gave me, I think, something like $10,000 a year retainer. And the rest of my payment of any fee that I would, and I could spend even, you know, full time on it, but the rest of the fee was a small royalty on every book sold.
Are you still getting your royalties?
I'm still getting royalties on Naked Lunch, yeah. I'm very happy when I see it's doing well.
Now, how did it happen that finally we had a decision by the Supreme Court that compelled those who wish to suppress something to look at the work in its entirety as a whole?
Well, in the earliest cases, and in this country, until the Roth decision, in fact, judges who wanted to suppress a book would find it easy to do so. And prosecutors who wish to bring about a conviction of the publisher of a book found it easier to do so if they could persuade the court, and if the court could persuade any appellate court, that the correct way of deciding obscenity was simply by examining excerpts from the book that in themselves seemed obscene. This, of course, authors and publishers and their lawyers were fighting against this rule, which came from the old, came from England and came from the old case of Regina versus Hicklin, I believe, is when it originated. Had been fighting it for a long time, but getting nowhere. Occasionally, an enlightened judge would refuse to do it and would, one way or another, get around what was then a rule, which was that you could decide whether a book was obscene from isolated excerpts. That rule, that principle, was followed by the Massachusetts Supreme Court into the late 30s, as late as the 30s, with regard to one of Theodore Dreiser's novels. His novel, An American Tragedy, was held obscene in Massachusetts, and that finding was upheld by the Supreme Court on the basis, it was a two-volume work, it was an immense work, and there were a few isolated passages which the prosecution and the lower courts had relied on to say that the book obscene, and the Supreme Court of Massachusetts said, yes, the book is obscene, and we don't have to read the two volumes, and we've read these excerpts, and that's enough. Because our rule is that you can tell a book by its excerpts. Okay. When Brennan decided Roth in 1957, he announced a number of principles of sort of liberal construction, which included that a book had to be, or a work, had to be taken as a whole, and that in the effort to determine whether it was obscene, and that any passages or excerpts would have to be examined in their context.
That was really the death knell, wasn't it?
Pardon?
That was the death knell.
That spelled the beginning of the end of literary censorship in this country. However, there's an interesting recent development in that area. And you may know that, remember the Cincinnati prosecution of the curator of the museum there that showed Mapplethorpe's paintings or photographs. The judge in that case, it was a prosecution instigated by one of these pressure groups, Cincinnati Community for Action for Clean Whatever Living or Clean Literature and Art. And they had mounted a tremendous campaign to bring about a prosecution of the curator of the gallery that was about to show, and that was showing, the Mapplethorpe exhibition. And in fact, the police came in, and they brought the grand jury in to look at it, at the pictures, and then they indicted the curator, Dennis Berry, I think his name was. And the judge, fortunately, the jury didn't pay any much attention to the judge in that case, because the jury, as you know, acquitted Dennis Berry on all counts of obscenity and two counts of child pornography for showing Mapplethorpe. But the judge, who had a background as a prior prosecutor and sheriff, I think, of the vigilante type, ruled that, as a matter of evidence, that the jury would only be able to consider those 8 or 10 photographs, the most extreme sadomasochistic photographs in the show that the prosecution relied on to demonstrate that they were obscene or child pornographic.
As an attempt to break with the Brennan philosophy.
An attempt to break that down, exactly. And even though the jury then was restricted to looking at these, you know, horrendous, really shocking examples of a very small part of the beautiful, otherwise beautiful, Mapplethorpe exhibition, the jury acquitted him.
That's
and the
sure.
jury did that, had to do it because of the expert testimony of the artistic value, so that the Brennan doctrine that if it's art, it's got to be protected and it cannot be obscene. That doctrine held strong even in the Cincinnati case, even under these pressures.
How long has it been since we've had a book that's been suppressed in this country?
Well, not very long. If you, by book, you include, as I imagine you do, illustrated books. Because there was a book called Show Me, which
St. Martin's Press, but they dropped that voluntarily.
Yeah, they dropped it voluntarily, but they dropped it because... and directly after, the Supreme Court, which is now the, at that time I think it was the Burger Court, had upheld the constitutionality of New York's child pornography law. And the decision of the Supreme Court in that case did not, in the area of child pornography, did not recognize that if material was art or had artistic value, or any kind of social value, instructional, scientific, educational, did not recognize that any such value would provide a defense or immunity to prosecutions for child pornography. In other words, the Brennan Doctrine, if material has literary, artistic, or social value, is a kind of defense. It cannot be found obscene. That makes it a defense.
That's the problem now, that they have tried to equate child abuse with child pornography, and it's not necessarily the same thing.
They not only tried to equate child abuse with child pornography, they're now equating child nudity. With child pornography.
Clean
and nudity of a child is, you know, anyone under 18 years of age. There's been some, you know, horrendous activity going on usually at the federal level in the prosecution or threatening of prosecution of fine art photographers who work with children and who photograph them nude or half nude or semi nude. And I've talked to two of the country's best photographers, Sally Mann and Jock Sturgis, Sally Mann from Virginia and Jock Sturgis from California, and they are operating in a state almost of terror, of kind of a quiet terror of what can happen to them for pursuing their art.
Mr. DeGrazi, we're really out of time. I just have one more question I'd like to ask you. Are you pretty well satisfied with your efforts and what has been done to end censorship in this country, or what do you see for us in the future?
Well, when I began writing the book, there wasn't this. It was before the explosion of attacks and assaults on art performers, art performance artists, and graphic artists. And then when I began the book and was writing the book, I felt pretty good. The printed word and literature had really been liberated, and I'd played a role in that liberation. And I felt authors and publishers could go about their work without worrying about going to jail or having their work suppressed and destroyed. But in the last few years, and I wrote the book over a period of 8 years, but the last few years have seen these explosion of hostility and anger and aggression against artists and writers and photographers who deal with subjects which religious subjects or sexual subjects, and deal with it in a different way than writers did, than literary people did. And they're in very serious danger now, and it's particularly worrisome that we have the Supreme Court that we have today. Everyone acknowledges that it's dominated by conservatives, and everyone is in fear that they're going to let their political agendas obscure the need, and the desperate need, and the desperate right that artists, as well as writers, and those who put artists on, promote them and publicize them and present them, are going to be placed in fear and jeopardy of prison, other kinds of punishment.
So your advice, I guess, to people who believe firmly in the First Amendment would be to be vigilant?
Well, it has to be more than vigilance. You have to get active. You have to fight this. You have to help and support artists and writers and publishers and museum curators and anyone who is trying to defend the rights of artists and writers to continue to create.
Edward DeGrazi, it's a wonderful and enlightening book, Girls Lean Back Everywhere. Thank you very, very much.
Thank you.